It's Friday, June 28, 2013. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. On Wednesday, the Supreme Court of the United States made history. On Thursday, it was the United States Senate. Yesterday, the Senate passed an historic piece of immigration legislation, adopting by a vote of 68-32 a comprehensive reform of America's immigration laws. Now, the issue of immigration has been controversial in the United States almost from its beginning as a nation. As you go back to recurring rounds of immigration, you'll discover that America has faced the same questions over and over again. Whether the immigrants were coming from the south of London or eventually from Wales and Ireland, from Italy or from Germany, from Eastern Europe, or more recently from waves of Hispanic and Latino immigration, largely from Mexico, the issues are recurringly the same. How does America, a nation by definition of immigrants, assimilate newcomers, and how does it maintain an orderly process, a legal process, of allowing persons who aspire to be citizens of the United States to become so, and to become so in a way that actually aids and builds the American experiment? Over the course of the last several years, especially over the last two decades, America has adopted an incompetent, ineffectual, and intellectually dishonest form of immigration. We have immigration laws on the books. We complain about the fact that they are not policed. On the other hand, our economy depends upon the fact that we selectively, at least selectively, ignore our own immigration laws when it is to our benefit. And we are a nation, we need to remember, that has built its population not only through birth rate, but through an immigration rate. And that has been true ever since the beginning of the American Republic. We are a country that is deeply divided over current questions of immigration. There are some on the left who make irresponsible suggestions about what America should do, suggestions that amount to becoming something of an international nation without any sense of national sovereignty and the preservation of a national border. On the other hand, there are those who are irresponsible voices on the right, irresponsible in the first place by denying reality, suggesting that even as you have something like 12 million undocumented persons in the United States, that somehow it is both politically and economically feasible actually to remove them. That is not going to happen. The other irresponsible voices from the right tend to want to dissuade people from coming to the United States who are not like us. That is a grave difficulty. And from a Christian perspective, a pernicious and gospel-offending category. We need to recognize that even as irresponsible voices from both the right and the left add loud voices to this conversation, most Americans are undoubtedly in the position of being reasonably persuaded that some kind of comprehensive immigration reform is necessary. This is where the political stratification of this country becomes a truly dangerous reality. Far too many people, especially in the United States House of Representatives, are in congressional districts where they fear someone running from their right on the conservative side, or from their left on the liberal side. This drives members of Congress into the extremes and makes far more difficult any possibility of comprehensive reform, which, after all, requires compromise. Why does immigration reform have to be comprehensive? Why couldn't we just take issue after issue? Why couldn't we take border concerns and then take immigration concerns and then take a path to citizenship and separate all these issues? It's because it is actually politically impossible to do so. The only kind of meaningful immigration reform we can achieve is a comprehensive immigration reform. That's because the political compromises necessary to get all of these pieces together require that different parts be compromised in different ways. If that sounds antithetical to what you hope the government to do, you don't understand how government works. If either party in the Senate or in the House of Representatives had an absolute control over that chamber, it would be able to drive an immigration reform bill that would serve in only one direction. That would either be that which is propounded by liberals or that which is suggested by conservatives. But in reality, in a divided government, which is divided not only by the separation of powers, but also by the stratification of political parties, and at the end of the day, no one is going to like many provisions of any kind of comprehensive law. But that's true when it comes to the tax code. That's certainly true when it comes to a farm bill. That's true with the defense reauthorization piece of legislation, and it's certainly true when it comes to comprehensive immigration reform. The Senate has passed this measure. The vote is very significant, 68-32. That means that at least 14 Republicans joined with Democrats in order to pass the legislation. This is going to set up a very interesting political dynamic in this country. But from a Christian worldview perspective, we need to keep a couple of things very much in mind. First of all, we need to remember how blessed we are to live in a country where people want to join us rather than to flee us. As the demographer Joel Kotkin points out, we are very blessed to be in a country people are trying to move to rather than to move from. That kind of aspirational movement is really, really important. That indicates that what's going on in this country is actually far more attractive to people outside than what is going on in their own countries. Now, one of the interesting things to watch right now is the fact that the economic situation in Mexico has improved to the point that massive waves of immigrants from Mexico are unlikely. But what we're looking at is the reality that some degree of immigration is almost assured. And furthermore, we have adopted an economic system that requires workers that do not come from within ourselves, from within our own population. The other thing Christians need to keep in mind is that the American birth rate has fallen to the rate that we need immigrants to come for two reasons. We need immigrants to come just so that they bring themselves. But we also need immigrants to come because they bring their children and have children once they arrive and have children at higher rates than do Americans. The bill adopted yesterday in the Senate provides for a 13-year path to citizenship. That may sound like a very long time, but it actually needs to be a long time. The moral reality here is that people who are without documentation and are not here in legal terms from the Immigration and Naturalization Service, as is in accord with law, should have some period of time they have to spend proving themselves to be actually aspirants for American citizenship, willing to do the things that are necessary in order to make very clear they want to buy into the totality of the American dream. And something like a path to citizenship is absolutely necessary, just even given the numbers. It is untenable to think that it is to our national advantage to have millions of people living here who are shut out permanently from the American dream. America, at all costs, must not turn itself into something like the nation of India, in which we have citizens and something like untouchables. That is not only immoral, it's not economically or politically workable. And when political leaders insinuate that something like that is possible, they do not serve us well. Christians, of course, privilege the rule of law, but that is a two-way street. That means that the law must be respected and observed, but it also means that a responsible society must put in place a system of laws that is fair and equitable and makes sense. We are caught right now in a position of national hypocrisy that has international embarrassment attached to it. We have a system of immigration laws we do not even intend to enforce. We do not intend to enforce our borders. We say we have border patrols, and yet we make ourselves very vulnerable to those who would break those laws and circumvent those processes. We say we do not believe in allowing people without documentation to enter, and yet we have created an economic system, especially in agribusiness and in the service economy, that does not allow for the actual performance of those sectors without people being here who supposedly should not be here. In a situation this politically complex, it is very difficult to say that Christians must agree on points A, B, or C. Clearly, Christians may disagree on any number of issues related to immigration reform, but what we should agree upon is this. We are very blessed to be in the United States of America. We are very privileged to be in a nation where people are trying to join us rather than to flee us. Christians must understand the necessity of having an honest system of laws that we actually intend to honor and to enforce. And we must understand that citizenship should be seen as something to which people aspire. It should be an achievement, not a gift. It should be understood that to join the American dream requires something of every single American citizen, the newest as well as the oldest. And we need to be thankful, those of us who are born in this country, that we got our citizenship as a birthright we didn't earn or deserve. It was simply given to us. But then again, Christians have a good understanding for that kind of language. We refer to it as grace. So even those who operate from a Christian worldview may see the immigration issue in different terms, but we should agree upon a set of priorities that includes honesty and justice and, of course, a generous welcome, knowing that that is not only our moral obligation, but also in our national self-interest. In other words, we should be thankful to be in a country that is even troubled by the political controversy of an immigration reform of this consequence. And we need to hope that the House of Representatives can find its way to a workable, reasonable set of legislative priorities, and then that the two houses of Congress can come together. Because one of the things that would not serve this nation well is to have an attempt at this point at comprehensive immigration reform fail. That would be a bipartisan failure and a failure for the nation at large. Americans will be thinking for a long time about what the Supreme Court's actions this week, its decisions on same-sex marriage, mean not only for the nation, but for us, for our churches, and for our families, and of course for our communities as well. Mixed signals were sent in the immediate aftermath of the Supreme Court. One of the strangest signals was sent by President Obama, On the day that the decisions were handed down, President Obama sided with the court, said that he joined in the celebration of the court's decisions, and then called for the day when all 50 states would recognize legal same-sex union. This is the president who ran in 2008 against same-sex marriage and in 2012 for it. Speaking in Africa, President Obama, who is, after all, not only president, but also a lawyer, said this, quote, "It's my personal belief, but I'm speaking now as a president, as opposed to as a lawyer, that if you've been married in Massachusetts, if you move someplace else, you're still married, and that under federal law, you should be able to obtain the benefits of any lawfully married couple," end quote. Presumably, the president was speaking then about the effect of the courts striking down to the Defense of Marriage Act, meaning that so far as the federal government is concerned, according to the Supreme Court this week, it can no longer limit the definition of marriage to a heterosexual union. But then the president went on to say this, "What's true, though, is you still have a bunch of states who do not recognize the Supreme Court." And the president said, "We're going to have to go back and do a legal analysis of what that means," end quote. Well, now we're all having to do an analysis of what in the world the president means. What did the president mean when the day after the Supreme Court handed down those two decisions, he said, "What's true, though, is you still have a bunch of states who do not recognize the Supreme Court"? The Supreme Court's decision in the DOMA case didn't address the states at all. It addressed the federal government. It said that the federal government could not limit the definition of marriage to the union of a man and a woman. It didn't say anything about the states. It was a case that was directed entirely to the federal government. In the case of the Proposition 8 case, the court did not speak to the states, but rather spoke back to its own lower court, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, and said that it had wrongly taken the case because there was no standing. The case is simply turned back to the state of California and to the U.S. District Court there. What in the world is President Obama talking about? Perhaps the most likely interpretation of the president's words is that he's saying that some states, that means the states without legal same-sex marriage, are not listening to the court's opinion in the majority opinion by Anthony Kennedy in the DOMA case, in which he says that opposition to same-sex marriage is deeply rooted in animus or in hatred towards homosexuals. In other words, maybe the president of the United States is saying to those states that don't have legal same-sex marriage, that is 38 states in this union, that they need to get with the program and with the U.S. Supreme Court. That is a massive misunderstanding of the court's role. It's also a massive confusion about what the court said in the two decisions handed down this week. Nearly everything a president of the United States says is closely scrutinized and, by the very fact that he is president, very influential. These statements by President Obama in Africa do not help, and they may indeed cause more confusion when we try to figure out exactly what the president means when he says that there are states, with reference to these cases, that do not recognize the Supreme Court. The president also said that he would put his administration clearly behind the momentum to apply the striking down of DOMA so that the thousands of federal statutes that have something to do with marriage will be reinterpreted by regulatory bodies and the departments of government. In the president's words, quote, "We now have to comb through every federal statute," end quote. And we can presume that's exactly what his administration will be doing. Meanwhile, on the Republican side, Politico is reporting that gay marriage is unlikely to be a focus of Republican messaging in 2014. One of the things we need to keep in mind is that in a fallen world, political parties act in their own best interest, or at least what they perceive to be their own best interest. In the case of the Republican Party, you can count on the fact that at least at the level of leadership, they're going to be doing everything they can to try to distance themselves from the issue of same-sex marriage. Politically speaking, they're going to see it as a losing issue. They're going to see it as baggage they don't want around the neck of the party as it tries to put forth candidates in the 2014 elections. Of course, both political parties are looking not only to 2014, but to 2016 and the next presidential election. And of course, they're also looking beyond. Republicans, at least at the national level, seem to be making the quick political calculation that same-sex marriage is a losing issue. Speaking on NPR yesterday, Jonathan Rauch, a major proponent of gay marriage, said that at the grassroots level, the conservative opposition to same-sex marriage is likely to continue. But then speaking of what he called of the grass tops level, he said that political leaders, even those that have been leading a political party such as the GOP, the Republicans, are likely to do everything they can to talk as little as possible about same-sex marriage and to try to move the messaging of the party far beyond the issue. Politico cited a GOP strategist who said, and I quote, "It would be surprising if the party committees or higher-profile outside groups engaged on the marriage issue. In other words, says Politico, messaging on marriage next fall is more likely to occur in direct mail or targeted internet ads than in broadcast commercials. What does that mean? It means that you're going to see both political parties in a very different position on same-sex marriage by the time we reach 2014. If you're looking at your calendar, that means next year. The Democrats are going to seize upon recent momentum on the issue of same-sex marriage as validating the great shift in that party as reflected in their 2012 national platform. The Republicans are going to be saying, same-sex marriage? What same-sex marriage? Trying to move on past the issue in order to avoid political damage. This is where Christians are reminded, indeed humbly reminded, that no political party serves our interests. And that, as the politicians themselves know, in the world of politics, there are no permanent alliances, no permanent enemies. Next, even as Christians know there is a great political and cultural divide, even a moral divide in this country, we need to keep ourselves ever mindful of the fact that there is a great theological divide that is even more fundamental, because theology precedes culture, morality, and all the rest, certainly politics. Christians, therefore, would be interested in a report from Jeff Walton of the Institute for Religion and Democracy about what took place in Washington's National Cathedral, that is, a cathedral of the Episcopal Church USA, on the evening after the Supreme Court declared the Defense of Marriage Act dead. As Walton reports, Washington National Cathedral officials hosted a special service for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender persons the day of the U.S. Supreme Court rulings that struck down the Defense of Marriage Act and effectively overturned California's voter-approved Proposition 8. Advertised as, quote, a service of thanksgiving celebrating an increase in compassion and equality, end quote. All that was in the title for the service. The June 27 ceremony sought to place the Supreme Court rulings within the narrative of liberation struggles. As Walton reports, a congregation of approximately 300 clustered at the front of the Episcopal Cathedral, still undergoing repairs from a 2011 earthquake. Chairs were arranged to face the procession. While the congregation was overwhelmingly middle-aged whites, songs were often African in origin, in which participants declared, quote, we are marching in the light of God, end quote, even as they were accompanied by African drums. Several congregants enthusiastically waved rainbow flags emblazoned with the word equality as choir and clergy processed to the Zimbabwean song Uwe Mose, Come All You People. Cathedral Dean Gary Hall said, it's a great night, isn't it? Then, in response to a standing ovation, he asked, was that standing ovation for God or for the court? Saying, we have turned the corner in the faith community's life, end quote. Declaring that the Episcopal Church has been, quote, on a trajectory, the dean of the cathedral traced changed views of marriage through Christian history, now to same-sex unions. According to the IRD, quote, he offered no prediction on what was next, end quote. Episcopal bishops across the country seem to be falling over themselves to applaud the Supreme Court. Bishop Marianne Edgar Buddy of the Episcopal Diocese of Washington said that the Supreme Court ruling was, quote, moving the country closer to the vision of equality and unity, and called Episcopalians to recommit to what she called this holy work. Los Angeles Episcopal Bishop John Bruno declared, quote, we rejoice at the repeal of DOMAs, discrimination against LGBT families. In his announcement, Bruno touted, quote, provisional liturgies for the blessing of same-gender couples, these liturgies adopted by the church's General Convention last summer. In Arizona, Episcopal Bishop Kirk Smith also celebrated the court's rulings, proclaiming an indiscriminate inclusion and saying that the United States, quote, has come closer to a truth which has been ours as Christians from the beginning, that God loves everything and everyone God has made, and that we are called to reflect God's love for us and how we love each other, end quote. In other words, this great theological divide is one that will divide American congregations and denominations. Indeed, it already does. Just take the issue of homosexuality and the interpretation of Scripture. Press that back, and what you find is the issue of the authority of Scripture. Press that back, and what you have is a vision of God. The vision of God, who, as Francis Schaeffer said, is the God who is there and is not silent and has given us his inerrant and infallible word, or the God who somehow just wants to call us to inclusion. And the God, on the other hand, the God of liberal theology, that seems to be adjusting himself and all the beliefs he requires to whatever the changing cultural motifs of the day. In other words, in the wake of all of this, Christians are reminded that we are most likely to be in a moral minority. A minority, once again, on the issue of marriage. Christians were there before, and we now find ourselves in the same place again. But the terrain is changed. Even though human beings throughout history have often found themselves confused about marriage, no previous generation of human beings has ever been so confused as to think that marriage might be something other than the union of a man and a woman. The union of a man and a man, or a woman and a woman, no previous society has ever institutionalized, nor recognized, much less celebrated, anything like that. So if you're looking way out into the future for the brave new world, just recognize it. The signals this week are abundantly clear. The brave new world is right here and right now. And so we come to the end of today's issue of The Briefing. As usual, recognizing that there are more things left unsaid than were possible to say. More issues left unconsidered than we had the time to consider. It will always be that way. It just feels especially urgent on the last edition of The Briefing for the year 2012-2013. We'll be back on Thursday, August the 1st, with the 2013-14 season of The Briefing. I want to remind you how thankful I am that you listen, and how thankful I am from time to time to hear from you, sometimes with suggestions about issues to discuss, sometimes with conversation about what we've been talking about on The Briefing, sometimes just with a reminder that you're out there. I hope the month of July is wonderful for you, filled with God's blessings, opportunity for rest, relaxation, and also an opportunity for reflection about the issues Christians should consider in this life and in the age to come. I'll meet you back here on August the 1st. Until then, thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again on Thursday, August the 1st, 2013, for the next edition of The Briefing.